From Southern California, this is The Circle of Insight, a show about everything in psychology. Hear the latest in news and views on psychology. Our motto is simple. Wherever there is psychology involved, we are there. And now, here's your host of The Circle of Insight, Carlos Vasquez.
From wherever you are around the world, welcome and thank you for joining us. Today we're going to look at the psychology of self-deception. That's right. Am I self-deceiving myself right now? We're going to find out more about this topic with Dr. Robert Trivers. Dr. Robert Trivers is an evolutionary biologist at Rutgers University. He also won the Crawford Prize, a highly acclaimed prize that he earned. And I say he earned it because he really does deserve it. So let's welcome Dr. Trivers to the show. Welcome to the circle, Dr. Trivers.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Trivers also has wrote the book, The Folly of Fools, The Logic of Deceit and Self-Deception in Humans, and that's what we're going to try to figure out today. So, Dr. Trivers, what is self-deception?
Well, the simplest way to put it would be it's lying to yourself. So deception is lying to someone else or to another organism. It's extremely widespread in nature. But self-deception is where you're lying to yourself. You're hiding some portion of the truth from yourself. Now, deception doesn't create a big logical or evolutionary problem because there's lots of ways in which, by deceiving you, I can gain an advantage. Access to your wallet, access to your wife, for God's sake. All kinds of relationships in which deception, if undetected, can give you a benefit. But the question is, what's the benefit of self-deception? That's like taking $5 out of my left pocket and putting $5 into my right pocket. Where's the net gain? So the function of self-deception's long been a logical puzzle. And a series of people have come up with partial and false answers. And I believe it was given to me, thank the all-merciful one, to propose the first scientific theory for why we practice self-deception, and it couldn't be simpler. It's to improve our deception of others. So if I'm lying to you now about something you actually care about, better you're close to me and know me somewhat, you can pay attention to the subtle signs of self-knowledge that I'll give off when I'm lying. One example is we have an unconscious tendency to raise our voice during deception, and that's because we're tense. And that's because if we're caught, we may suffer an immediate reversal of fortune. You know, when your wife catches you in a lie, you may be in for some heavy shit. So you're under pressure when you're lying, and that causes you to hold in the diaphragm, which causes you automatically to have the voice rise. So self-deception, if I'm unconscious that I'm doing any of this, then those avenues of detection are unavailable to you. So that's the kind of first basic part of the analysis.
Let me ask you this question, if I can. When your voice goes up when you're lying, is that an evolutionary adaptation for some reason there? I mean, are we trying to protect ourselves from getting in trouble?
I would not say it was. I would say, in general, the less information you give away, the better for you. There's in context of being cryptic and camouflage and all that kind of stuff. So you don't want to make detection available to others. No, my interpretation would be that it's an inevitable consequence, so to speak, or near inevitable consequence of the way we're built. That naturally, when we're tense up, it tenses up our whole diaphragm, which has the side effect, not selected for per se, just the side effect of having the voice go up. Then selection works on the people that are trying to detect deceivers, and they may notice that correlation. I mean, I'll give you an absurd example that happened to me about 5 or 8 years ago. A woman was denying to me something that, in fact, I was not accusing her of, which is having a lesbian relationship with this other woman. And so she says, "You think I'm there with Sherry?" And her voice shot up 2 octaves. If she had had her voice under control, it would have just gone up mildly at the key word. Because the key word in a lie, again, is when you're going to be most under stress. So if you listen to the voice even more subtly, you may be able to hear the key part of it. And the key part for her was a woman's name, only she lost it, and it shot up 2 octaves.
Fascinating. Fascinating stuff. So I understand, I know from the book, which is a fabulous book, you talk about how it benefits us. And one of the reasons it really benefits more the recipient, actually, that's reciprocal altruism. I'll have to get back to that. We'll get back to that topic a little bit later. So how does self-deception benefit us in evolutionary psychology idea?
Well, that's an interesting question. And I'm glad you asked it. I mean, social psychologists have tended to give self-deception intrinsic mental benefits. This is kind of like, I wouldn't get out of bed in the morning if I knew how bad things really were. So optimism gets us up and going. Then the more sophisticated extension is believing we can accomplish a task keeps us up later at night working on the task, and by God, we end up achieving the task, which we wouldn't if we hadn't falsely believed we could. But there's such a logical contradiction just embedded in that whole way of thinking. And you're saying to yourself, why the hell can't you design a brain that simply makes the appropriate adjustment? Here's how hard I'm going to try when I think I got a realistic chance. Here's how hard I'm going to try when it looks hopeless. And make that the basis. Why use self-deception, for God's sake, to hype the system? So I think those people actually usually have it backwards. And I could give you an example, but I'm, you know, hesitant to bore you way beyond tears on this. But I would say the social psychologist rationalize self-deception as being good for us intrinsically. I'm saying, no, it's not. You're more ignorant. You've made more information into your unconscious where it's less usable or not usable in a way that you can consciously manipulate. You know, that's the whole complicated problem you mentioned. We might get to consciousness and unconsciousness. But in any case, in principle, self-deception ain't good for you, except insofar as it fools you. Now, the more I worked on it, the more I realized that the great majority of my self-deception I was unconscious of. In fact, it was unconscious processes running it from the get-go. So psychologists have shown that we will automatically look in the direction of something that gives us a beneficial side effect or image or whatever. And that'll be our first glance. So it's not even like we have to look once to decide which is red and blue. We see red out of the corner of our eyes, so to speak. This is an unconscious process. So, you know, when you're watching, let's say you're watching a whole series of Republicans coming out of their committee rooms and climate denial, there's no human effect on climate change, the best way to handle a recession is to cut expenditures instead of the exact reverse, which is exactly the proper solution and so on. So when I watch these organisms marching out together and then preaching to me and the rest of us, I honestly sit there and I say, how effing self-deceived are you? How much is this BS, something that you're saying, all right, it's holy C-R-A-P, but it's going to sound good, so let's say it. Most of them, I think, are pretty well self-deceived. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. I think a lot of the organism is on board. Hmm. I don't know. I
completely agree with you.
What's that?
I completely agreed. I actually, now as we're talking about this, some things popped up in my head. So now Dr. Trivers is what I call in the danger zone. These are the impromptu questions that come during the interview. But yes. Overconfidence, is that something that's good or bad? Because we're kind of self-deceiving ourselves on that one. If you're a sport athlete and you're saying you're better than you are so you can try to perform better, how does that fit into this paradigm?
That's a very good question, and I even like your sub-question. Because when you get into a field like I did and decide, well, I'm going to master the whole effing thing, so if there's relevant evidence, whatever corner, I'm going to use it. So I did exactly what follows from what you're saying. I said there's got to be a literature on sports and overconfidence because it's so goddamn easy to measure. We can ask you what's your chance you're going to sink the next three-pointer, you know. Now, the literature is thin, so that's your first disappointment. And that's true of various subsections of this whole topic. Some people who write nasty reviews in my book say, but he left out this and he left out that. And I'm saying, yeah, mofo, it don't exist. That's why it's left out. But forgive me, I've lost my argument there. You're asking about overconfidence. First of all, I think overconfidence is one of our deepest self-deceptions because I think it has roots that go way before language. So when you and I squared off 50 million years ago, we're not talking about 6 million, 50 million years ago, we're just small little mammals, you know, hiding while the dinosaurs go extinct. When we squared off then, one thing we did was to evaluate the other individual's sense of confidence. You do that in a fight. If you look nervous and I'm standing off against you, it makes me feel better. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And if you look like, yeah, come on, Bob, you want to get your ass whipped? Keep right on coming. That in itself will tend to inhibit my behavior. So I think both in courtship, where there's an advantage in thinking you're better looking and you're more attractive than you are within limits, of course. It has to be within limits. Then I think there's been selection for it. And we do have lots of examples of where overconfidence is costly. They did a beautiful study of people investing in the stock market in the 90s. It was like a huge sample, because it was off the internet. These are people that had to be doing it themselves. Well, you know, it's a form of gambling because you have to pay a fee. It might be a 1% cost per transaction, but whatever the charge is for the trade, that's what the house is taking in. So guess what? Men lose 3% of their money every year simply because of overbetting. That is, they're trading stocks too often. If they just sat there and said, all right, I made a series of decisions, let's see how they turned out, at least they would have saved all the transaction costs that they don't save because they keep betting, even though, as you know, it's basically random. The few people who really know how the stock market is working ain't talking to you and me. They living off in another world, brother. So in any case, it was a nice example of how overconfidence in men compared to women was about a 3% cost versus a 1.5% cost. So men paid twice as much because they were overconfident.
Now, let me ask you this question. I was going to mention the Pygmalion effect, but I think you kind of answered that already through all the other examples that you used. So when it comes to the self-deception, is it, it's unconscious, as you said, and the unconscious factors are composed of a lot of things. They're composed of past experiences, past relationships, evolutionary adaptive mechanisms. Which one do you think weighs the most when it comes to self-deception? Is it the evolutionary adaptive functions, or is it going to be our past experiences, or is there a way to even quantify?
Well, we're way from being able to quantify a question like that. That's kind of like, you know, that's a fantasy I would have as to how 20 or 30 or 40 years from now, when we actually develop a real quantitative, rigorous, integrated theory and science of all this, then we can answer those questions. By the way, we're getting little chunks of it, neurophysiology, some interesting stuff. Not one-tenth as much interesting stuff as they claim. They've been overclaiming for 50 years now, brother. But in any case, where I would expect it from the bigger forces is a very good question. I mean, just to give you one aspect of the subtlety of it, since you mentioned it, you mentioned early effects. Well, early effects often occur in the nuclear family between parent and offspring, and their interests are not identical. But the parent has a, well, they both have an opportunity to affect each other's psyche. But initially, the parent, through discipline and this and that, in principle, can manipulate the offspring's psyche. So now you can have self-deceptions that are implanted in you that aren't even in your own narrow self-interest, if you hear what I'm saying. They're still costly in the sense that any self-deception takes you further away from reality, and that's a dangerous game to play in with life. But this one is imposed on you by your parents. You know, I've outlined some in a recent something I've written. And so there you're fighting your own unconscious. You know what I mean?
Sure.
Where you're freeing yourself from it. Let me tell you this. This is from my book, and it was one of the most fascinating things I learned writing my book. I knew none of this stuff when I started working in Berlin in 2008. Immunology and self-deception. And here was a key result, Jamie Pennebaker, University of Texas. What he discovered was that sharing trauma in a private journal that wasn't even going to be read by anybody else had immediate positive effects on your immune system. So what he did was he brought people into the lab and he interviewed them separately and asked you to say what was the most traumatic thing that happened in your childhood. And, you know, for a young girl, it might be sexual abuse. Well, boys do sometimes. Sometimes it's physical punishment. Sometimes death of a parent or divorce or whatever the hell it was. But you would try to get them to fess up that something was really traumatic. What was the most traumatic? Then you split the group into two. One group writes for 20 minutes every morning about the trauma. That's all they're doing. The other write about what they did that day. They're the control group. Now, here's what happens. For people that are writing about trauma, their mood goes down steadily. They are dwelling on something painful. That's exactly why they don't dwell on it. That's why they bury the stuff away, right? But if you watch their immune system, it starts climbing right away. Day one, day two, higher. Day three, your immune system is feeling better. 3 months later, your immune system is still elevated, and now your mood has caught up. Now the people writing about what they do next day, they're just flatlining it because they're the control group and there is no effect. So that's a fascinating finding. First of all, that sharing trauma is good for your health. More than half of all women who have suffered intimate, inappropriate sexual abuse when they're young have not told a single person, including their own mother. And yet, we know that sharing it, even with a goddamn scientist in the form of a private journal, has immediate beneficial effects. And I've seen it. I've seen it, I believe, my good friend, personally. I've seen women that I know that always have colds and always have this and always catch the flu and were very, very late to ever let on to me, who was the first person they let on to, what had actually happened to them, you know.
That's
so, yeah, and extremely important work, you know.
Welcome to Adelante. This is Adelante Recovery, and my name is Yvette Kuglin, and I'm part of the staff.
Adelante Recovery Center has helped people in dual diagnosis for 5 years. We accept most PPO insurances and provide luxury accommodations and 24-hour support. To speak with an admissions counselor, call 1-888-242-4450.
A lot of time we don't even know what's wrong with us, and sometimes we need to get away to figure that out. So if you want to go for a little retreat out in Corona Del Mar, which is a confidential location, we're here to help. So we're only a phone call away. Thank you.
Here's the last question I wanted to tackle from the first book, The Folly of Fools, and then we're going to talk a little bit about, in the second part of the show, reciprocal altruism, which I know you're famous for. But before we get to that topic, there was one part of the book that really intrigued me, and I can't remember the name of the test off the top of my head. I think it was the implicit association test, the
yes.
IAT. And that was a really interesting finding, especially during these days right now where racism comes up a lot. But
yes. The
interesting component was when they asked people how they viewed themselves, and the African Americans seem subconsciously to still view whites as better in a sense, or more, or good, or better than themselves. That was kind of a weird discovery for me. Why do you think that is?
Well, you are, I'm not blowing smoke up no part of your anatomy. You are extremely well informed. That is a very striking finding, and I, who teach a course on deceit and self-deception, was just drawing attention to it with the same IAT data there that you're talking about, because we expect an organism to be biased toward itself.
Yeah.
That should be your first stance in life, you know, and we don't mean biased in any kind of pejorative way to other people. You should care for, you know, your responsibility is yourself, for Christ's sake, and you should take that on first. So if you check out black people and white people on this IAT, this racial IAT, where you check how much the word good or the word bad is associated with black or white. Now, what's interesting is that for the explicit association, that's just where you're asking the person, how much do you like black? How much do you like white? Black people show a greater self-love than white people do. White people say, I like white, God damn it. Black people say, I love black. Okay. So now juxtapose that with what you were just saying, which is on the implicit association test, which is unconscious and measures reaction time to these words paired with these other words. You see, again, whites have an upward bias. Implicitly, they think they're more good and blacks are more bad. But on a number of these studies, blacks have a slight upward bias in the white direction. So what the hell's going on here? What I say is going on here is just what we were referring to earlier, only in the parent-offspring conflict context. You have people who have an imposed self-deception, and that's because they've grown up as an oppressed minority, which is a very important factor to bear in mind about African Americans. If you go to Jamaica, the black people, the darker people, will on average be poorer, and they may have been mistreated to some degree, but they are the overwhelming majority of the entire country. 85% call themselves dark, 13% call themselves brown, and we're down to white and shiny at one each. So in that case, you know, if you're imagining how hard was it to be an oppressed black Jamaican compared to an oppressed black American, there is no effing comparison, right?
That's a good point.
Just use the word lynch, L-Y-N-C-H, and we know the dreadful history. So that to me is a reflection of that. And I do believe there's some evidence that's hopeful that as black people become more dominant in the stage, you know, like, trust me, 30 years ago, black athletes could barely talk, you know. You know, how'd you score that? Red fast. You know, now black people are some of the most articulate, black athletes are some of the most articulate commentators on what's going on. So they are coming out from underneath this, to me, cultural oppression. And I think we'll see beneficial effects in that direction. So I hope anyway.
Well, I completely agree. I hope so, too. It was a disaster that happened to that ethnicity on this.
Yeah.
Let's go ahead and tackle a little bit. We got about 10 minutes left, and we'll tackle a reciprocal altruism.
I thought by now you were going to send me a raisin candy or something. Okay. Can I have a sip of beer while I'm talking to you, or is that out of the question?
No, you can if you like.
Go ahead. Keep talking.
Reciprocal altruism. What is reciprocal altruism, and how does it help us from an evolutionary perspective?
Well, it came to me in the context of kinship theory because Darwin was simple-minded but very general. It applied to most creatures and situations. It was simply surviving offspring. If you produce more surviving offspring than me, then your genes are becoming more numerous. End of the subject. Okay? Since the natural environment determines which one of us are going to be successful and which one isn't, there's a natural selection going on. Then Hamilton saw, wait a second, relatives are just as important, collateral relatives are just as important in principle as lineal descendants. So I'm just as related to my brother or sister, if we're a full sibling, that is related to both parents, as I am to my own child. So in principle, natural selection could favor me adding a sister to the world and having slightly less than one offspring subtracted, and that would be favored. Fine. Then I come into the field, and I say, well, that's all well and good, but if you look at humans, we have relationships that are as strong or stronger than kin, strong positive emotions, and they're called friends and friendship. So what's going on here? And we are more likely to do something for a friend, you know? You come over to my home and you need this and you need that and you're an actual friend, you know, I'll be hopping up and driving around and helping you, even though I might be helping another person, more likely to. So I thought the logic had to be reciprocal altruism. It had to be that we are trading benefits and costs, where in principle, whenever I do something nice for you, the cost is less than the benefit, so that if you just did it the other way around, both of us would be trading in lower costs for higher benefits, right? The only problem is that there's a tendency to cheat, and that's to either not reciprocate, which is easy enough to spot. You know, I do you something nice, the next time, shoes on the other foot, you say, never mind, Bob, I'm not doing nothing for you. Then I say, F you, and I break off the relationship. But there's something called subtle cheating, whereby you and I have a long-term relationship. But when you check it out, you know, aren't I always doing a little bit more for you than you are for me? You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So I felt like our sense of fairness and ultimately our sense of justice grew out of reciprocal altruism, not out of kinship. Because I am selected to act nice towards my brother whenever benefit is greater than half cost, without reference to whether this is fair or not. So anyway, that's reciprocal altruism. It's connected to fairness. It's connected to altruism. It can operate among kin. I mean, you can also say to your brother, hey, mofo, you know, you're not being reciprocal. So you can ask for reciprocity in relationships where you're more closely related. But the more distantly related you are, the more sure you are that if you've got a system of altruism, it's got to go along lines of reciprocity.
And there's some kind of survival component to that too, as well, right? I know there's some articles I think I've read where it can help you. If you got into a jam, it's better to have two or three people. So if you did something altruistically, you're hopefully they'll reciprocate later to help you in a moment of danger. If you look at the hunter-gatherers kind of component?
Yeah, when I said specify and speculate, and sure. But I'm, yeah. No, I'm just saying it's not like, I wouldn't take it for granted that you're getting the benefit back. Maybe I'm too cognitive about it. I don't disagree with any of your examples. You know, you've supported a group of people in a variety of situations, suddenly, blammo, now group cohesion, group power is critical. Maybe another group is attacking you. You know what I mean? And then the investment in the minor ties that bind may pay off in a big, much bigger route. So it obviously, with human groups, can get very complex very quickly, as it did.
You're absolutely right. Once again, Dr. Robert Trivers wrote the book, The Folly of Fools, The Logic of Deceit and Self-Deception in Human Beings. He is considered by many as one of the founding fathers, the pioneers of evolutionary psychology. Thank you so much, Dr. Trivers, for being on The Circle. Thank you, everyone, for joining us as well. Remember, well, actually, before we go, Dr. Trivers, is there anywhere else we can go to find more information about you and your work?
Carlos, God bless you and keep you. If I knew how to say that in Spanish, I would.
Is there a website you would like us to go to?
Yeah. RobertTrivers.com. And, or if you forgot, just Google my name and the second link will be RobertTrivers.com. For example, after you get access to all my publications, you can download every one except my books, but all the books you have links to, and the book that our host was kind enough to refer to is out now in six other languages, including Spanish and Italian and German and Brazilian, Portuguese and Korean and so forth and so on. So that for some of you, you might enjoy reading the book more in your own language, which is very gratifying to me. So in any case, RobertTrivers.com, yes, and you've been a most gracious host and most interesting, man. I've enjoyed this.
Thank you very much, Dr. Trivers. Thank you, everyone, for joining us. Remember, wherever psychology is involved, even if we're self-deceiving each other, we're there. We'll see you next time, everyone.